Good evening, everyone. My name is Sam Nasser, and this is Architecting Secure Microsoft.NET Applications. A little bit about myself. I've been a software developer since 1995. I come to you from the United States, where I started my own business, also known as NIS Technologies. I've been certified with a few certifications from Microsoft, also heavily involved in the user group community, and have been writing articles for Visual Studio Magazine. As a matter of fact, a good portion of this evening's content is going to be posted on that website, on that article. Also, I've been MVP for 2013 and 2014 as well. This is a brief agenda of items we're going to look to cover tonight. We're going to look at some of the tools that are available within Visual Studio. And these come standard, free of charge. And we're also going to look at some additional protective measures, what we can do outside of the coding perspective to secure our applications. Just a little bit of housekeeping items. Please keep in mind this is a forum for learning, so feel free to ask questions at any time. There's a microphone in the center if you wish to participate. Also, at any point in time, feel free to stop me and ask questions. And last but not least, please put your cell phones on vibrate. So, first, we have to ask ourselves, why security? Why do we have to be concerned with that? Well, as developers, we're really guardians of data, as I once heard. We're not just here to learn how to protect the data, but essentially, we're here to learn how to protect our jobs. Millions and possibly billions of dollars have been added up due to loss through hacking and stolen information, which essentially could translate into jobs lost. So some of the things that we need to look at protecting are the credit card numbers that our corporations utilize, corporate financial information, especially if you're in the financial information sector, and patient information, which is heavily guarded in the U.S., and I'm sure the same here as well. Another reason why we need to look at security is to ensure application integrity, that the application coming from company ABC will in fact be known to the user that it did come from company ABC and not some other malicious vendor or hacker in this case. Also, we need to be able to prevent the denial of service attacks. We need to make sure that our website is up consistently and ready to accept business at all times. The more time our website is down, that means that is business lost, and we'll touch on that in a little bit. Also, we need to ensure application authenticity, that when the customer is running the application, that it is in fact the application they intended to run. So what are the motives for some of these hackers? Well, it really varies, and actually the level and expertise of every hacker varies. You have some hackers that really just like to do it for a hobby, brag to their friends, hey, I broke into the Chase database, look what I got, but really didn't do anything with it. Some actually utilize that information for their own financial gain. There are some that use it for the sake of pride, showing it off to their fellow hackers. And don't think that hackers operate in a back room all by themselves. They actually have organized conferences very similar to this. They have user groups, published magazines, so it is a very well-organized effort and constantly ongoing. Again, their belief is we're not stealing information, we're just, it's a challenge for us to be able to penetrate through some of these security measures. Another motivation is religious or political. As elections are heated up in the U.S., there's sometimes websites for different candidates that are defaced and also from different religious affiliations where they're combating each other, sadly. That's one of the avenues that they used is to actually deface a competitor or someone else's website. And then last but not least, just for the sake of vandalism, a Twitter account was hacked about it 2 years ago for McDonald's, and they put up the Burger King logo and left the McDonald's name on it. Not a huge ordeal, but nonetheless, it just shows you how it spans the spectrum from childish to millions of dollars lost. So think of to yourself, what are some of the points of entry to an application? And consider the picture of this home that I have as an application. And just shout out some answers. What are some of the possible points of entry into this home? Front door. That's the obvious one, right? What else? Windows. What else? Chimney. Chimney, in the case of Santa Claus or Father Christmas, right? Absolutely. What else? I'm sorry? Through the cellar. Okay. So you get an idea that there are multiple points of entry that all need to be protected. Locking the front door simply just won't cut it. One hacker got really creative. We have a retail chain in the U.S. called Target, and what they did was they actually infiltrated through another vendor, which is an HVAC vendor that went in and was cleaning their ducts, and somehow they got hold of passwords and then passed it on to the hackers, and the hackers were essentially able to gain access that way. So it goes to show you, you can never really be assured that all the avenues are covered. You always have to stay on top of your game and make sure that every avenue is covered. This is just a brief list of the different methods of attack that exists out there. And by brief, I mean very brief. I actually had to trim this list down considerably to get it to fit on this slide. And there are many more out there, and the list also continues to expand. The more interesting ones that we'll talk about, we're going to look at social engineering, and we're also going to look at, we're going to discuss thumb drives. That was a hack attempt that I've seen before, where basically hackers would take several USB drives, approximately 32 gig in size, and they would load it up with malicious software, and they would scatter it in front of the entrance of an office building. So an accountant or an admin assistant would walk in, and she sees a 32 gig, or he sees a 32 gig thumb drive on the ground. What do you think their first reaction is going to be? Take it, right? And once they take it, what are they going to do? Plug it in. Now, most organizations, they block traffic coming into the organization, but traffic going out typically is not blocked. So what that malicious piece of software would do would essentially start copying anything with the .xls extension, because a lot of organizations function off of Excel. It would start copying any Word documents and then start sending them out through that PC. Error searching is another interesting one. How many have ever seen this message before? All right. I hear some chuckling in the room. Yes, we've all seen it. And what's the issue with this? The connection string. It's exposed in clear text in the light of day, right? So if you notice on the previous slide, I said error searching was one of them. There are a couple search engines out there that are utilized by hackers called Bing and Google. And just like those search engines search the internet for valid information, they also end up coming across things like this. So if someone publishes a website, let's say it's not completely in production yet, but they think no one's going to come to it, no one's going to find it, and they don't have the errors suppressed, something like this would be exposed. Now, what's the danger in exposing this? We see the connection string, but what's the big deal about that? Well, not just SQL injection, but what else? I'm sorry? The name of the database, I have the user ID and the password, and I know from there I can essentially tap into it, and then it gives me a good first step into hacking into the infrastructure. All right, so now we want to look at some of the tools that are used, and with every version of Visual Studio since 1.0, .fuscator came free of charge, installed on there by default. And .fuscator works with all .NET, with all .NET applications. It's included as part of the default install, and it supports highly complex development and build environments. The beautiful thing about it, it's very quick and easy. It gives you some low-hanging fruit to grasp so that you can obfuscate your application and get to a secure measure quickly. So let's take a look and see how that works. Before we get into the details of Obfuscator, I constructed an application that's very simple to use. Around the April timeframe, back in my homeland, we always have taxes that we need to do and submit it to the federal government. And so there are a lot of applications out there that help you to do that. And so this was built off of that scheme, but of course it's very simplified for the demonstration purposes. So essentially, again, I kept it very simple. I'm asking for a total salary. Then I print the total taxes due once the user clicks the calculate taxes button. And we'll take a look at the code on the back end. And essentially, again, kept very simple. For the event handler, I checked to see the amount that was entered, as in my salary.txt. And then I check if it was anything less than or equal to 100,000, then the tax rate is 37%. If it's greater than 100,000 and less than 250, it's 44%, on and on. Okay? Now I'm going to cut and paste this number, and I'll hold on to it in my buffer. And I'll go ahead and run the application. Actually, before I enter the salary, let me click calculate taxes. And here it displays a user-friendly message. Please contact this 1-800 number. Something went wrong in the application. And then if I enter in a valid number, I click calculate taxes, and it gives me the total tax due. Okay? Very simple. Now, I've already compiled this, and it ran just like you see. What I'm going to do now to show you that it's completely legit, I'm going to close down Visual Studio. And then I'm going to open up a command prompt. And then I have things scripted out in a file, so that way you don't have to watch me type, but rather I will be doing some cut and pasting of the paths. Now here I'm going to call a utility called ildasm. How many have heard of this utility? All right, so what ildasm does, it actually disassembles the code. And all I'm doing is I'm passing in the path to where my executable is located. And then the last parameter is I'm specifying slash out to create a myfile.il. So I'm essentially taking that exe, disassembling it, putting it into an intermediate language file. And then we take a look at the debug folder. And you'll see that I have a myfile.il created with the current, well, the date and time is still set back to my homeland. But looking at the IL, or the intermediate language, you see that a simple program has translated into many lines of code in intermediate language. Who knows what intermediate language is? Sir? Correct. So essentially, the .NET framework operates off of the IL. It takes that, converts it down to bit-level code that's actually machine-translated, and then it actually compiles and runs at that point. So with intermediate language, it's a combination between assembly and C syntax. So as I'm scrolling through, you'll see that there's a lot of gobbledygook, and we could literally spend an entire class, an eight-hour session, talking about IL. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a shortcut and say find, what was that tax rate again, 37241? And there it is. And I can modify this to be now, '11 instead of '37. Now in addition, we also had a user-friendly message that said call this 1-800 number. Nothing too malicious, but I just changed that text to something that isn't very user-friendly. And now I'm going to save this IL. And now what I'm going to do is the opposite, where I will now assemble it. And what I'm doing is I'm passing in the name of ildasm, which is the opposite of ildasm. We're now assembling it. As command line parameters, I'm passing in the intermediate language file, which I had just saved. And then I am specifying the output, which is going to replace that executable. And so once I click on that, I have operation completed successfully. Now I take a look and I see that that exe coincides with the current date and time. Now when I go to execute it, I click calculate taxes, and I get a not very friendly message from the get-go. Even worse, if I type in my salary, it's now giving me an incorrect percentage. And now if you notice, Visual Studio has been shut down. I was able to get my hands on the executable, modify it maliciously, and then put it back into production again for production use. Could this have an impact on organizations? Yeah? How many have seen this before? All right. So many of you, I take it, are seeing it for the first time? Okay. So what can we do to safeguard against something like this? Well, that's the beauty of Obfuscator. And it comes within Visual Studio. And let me go ahead and start Visual Studio again. And it's made by a company called Preemptive in my hometown of Cleveland, Ohio. And we'll go ahead and start that. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to save a copy of this exe. Actually I don't need to. What I will do is I will go ahead and start and add an input, and then I will go to the path of the executable. And then I'm going to specify that I want this executable to be .fuscated. So I'm pointing at this exe, and now I'm going to go ahead and run it. And it takes a minute to run, and after it's completed, you'll notice that in my folder, I'm going to have another folder created called .fuscated, which we'll see up here in just a second. And there it is. So now, if I was to disassemble that, I can call the ildasm utility. If I just call it without any command line parameters, it brings up the GUI interface. And then from here, I can open up the unobfuscated executable. And let me open up another version so we can compare it side by side. Now I'm going to open the obfuscated executable. Expanding it, you see that I have things that relate to my method names. So you see that I have the properties, the button calc tags, and everything that goes along with it, following the same naming convention that I had in my code. However, looking at the obfuscated version, really can't find those names. So you see what happened? It basically took all the method names and then it mapped it into something else that's obfuscated, something that doesn't make sense, it isn't easy to read, and then created an executable out of that. So looking at my folder that .fuscator had created for me, I still have an executable. I can still run this executable. Now, if you notice, this still contains that malicious code because I didn't modify it since, because I started with a bad executable. But it still runs just the same. The difference is I'm now able to obscure all the technical details and the functionality of how that executable runs and not make it available to a hacker, so now they cannot go through it and easily modify it. Okay? Any questions about what we've seen so far? Yes, sir. My constants. That's a very good question. So constants, if I was to buy, this is the community edition version. The professional version encrypts strings. But as far as numerics, they would still exist in here. Now what you would do in this case is you would either read from a database or you could do a string to int conversion. So that way, once it's in a string, it's encrypted and won't be seen. Okay. Another question in the back? What about performance? The folks at Preemptive, they said that because it works much like a zip file, where it creates a map. So you see here that I have a map.xml, and I open that up. Actually, let's open it up in IE. So you'll see that it's essentially a mapping of button exit click one is now going to be called method A, and then so on and so forth with all the different methods and the variables. So as far as performance, it actually enhances performance a little bit. Okay? Any other questions? Yes, sir. So if I understand your question correctly, does Obfuscator do much for securing the data? That's, yes, it's basically security by obscurity. And there is no one silver magic bullet to resolve all security issues. It's just a matter of putting as many hurdles in the step of a hacker as much as possible. So no, this is not the only magical solution that's going to resolve everything. But yes, it is a very handy tool. It's low-hanging fruit, comes free with Visual Studio, and it allows you to obfuscate the application that's in production to prevent someone from reading the code. Another issue is not just malicious software, but also piracy. Folks could also read into the code and then be able to duplicate some of that custom functionality that you have in there. Okay. Any other questions? Yes, sir. I'm sorry, I can hardly hear you.
The integration into VS, does it integrate?
Yes, I actually opened it up from Visual Studio.
Yeah, but it's not automatically
when you make. Oh, so you want to be able, the question, if I understand you correctly, you want to be able to automate the obfuscation through the build cycle.
Mm-hmm.
I am 99% sure that it does automate through the build process, but I will look into it and get back to you for sure. In the back? What happens is once you obfuscate it, you have a XML file here that is used for the mapping. And I believe that would integrate with that, and you'd be able to retrieve the error messages and point to the proper method names through that map.xml. Okay? Any other questions? If the map.xml will be deleted, what will happen? What do you guys think? I think the chuckles in the room pretty much say it all. You probably have to rebuild it at that point. Assuming you held on to your source code, you should also hold on to your map.xml as well. Okay? But once that file is gone, it's like losing the keys to the castle. Any other questions? All right. So we'll resume. So as you've seen, we were able to take an executable, modify it, and then put it back into production use. What can be done to prevent that? Well, we can obfuscate for one, but then another layer of protection is using SignTool. And SignTool is a command line utility that, again, installs by default with the .NET framework. It digitally signs the files. It allows you to be able to get a certificate from one of the certificate vendors like VeriSign and be able to actually sign an actual executable. And what that allows you to do is allows the user to verify the authenticity of that application. So when they go to install an application that has been maliciously modified, they're going to get something, an error message similar to this, where the publisher is listed as unknown. Now, this involves engaging the user to some degree because we need to let them know if you see publisher unknown or certificate is not valid, you shouldn't click and proceed on. So it's something that we also need to engage the user in, but this adds another layer of complexity into making sure that the application isn't easily hacked. BSA, or Baseline Security Analyzer from Microsoft. That is a free tool downloaded off the Microsoft website. It determines the security state by assessing your entire machine or entire network for that matter, and then it produces a very user-friendly report that talks about all the various OS settings, what needs to be modified, and I can't begin to tell you, every time I run it, I'm always in for a surprise. Every time I look at the reports, like, shoot, I forgot to turn off this type of access. It also analyzes all the individual components as far as IE, SQL, IIS. Another tool is ASP.NET Reg IIS.exe. Not a very easy name to say, but again, it's also a command line tool that is available from Microsoft, and it's installed by default in the .NET framework. Now, typically, this tool is used for doing items and registering things on IIS, hence the name Reg IIS. And you can also use it to display the different status of installed versions of ASP.NET if you're trying to troubleshoot something on IIS. But another purpose of it is encrypting and decrypting connection strings. So with a couple of basic commands, it allows you to encrypt a connection string that may in some cases include the user ID and the password and the database name, and encrypt that so again it becomes obscure to a hacker that may break into the server and take a look at the web config file. So let's just say, for example, that I was a hacker and I broke into a server and got access to a web config file. You can say, well, I have, I'm not using user credentials, I'm authenticating through my network user ID, but what's still being exposed in that connection string? What does every connection string contain? Database name, right? So that's going to be exposed out there, and this helps you to obscure that layer. The command line utility, again, very simple. What we're doing is we're calling the name of the executable, and then we're specifying the PEF flag for encryption, and we're specifying the connection strings because it's going to look into the web config file and look for the connection strings, and then the other parameter that I'll be passing in is the path to that web project where the web config is located. And then to decrypt it, it's essentially the same thing, except we're passing in a PDF flag instead of a PEF. So I'm going to skip this slide for just a second and jump into a demo of that. And let me close down a couple of things here. And going into my application, I have a solution where I have my web config with a human readable connection string. And there it is. And there's my connection string section. And here I have two connection strings, one for my actual production database and one for an ELMA database that I'm utilizing to capture error handling. Now what I'm going to do is call the command line utility. And again, all I'm doing is calling the executable, passing in the flags with PEF for encryption, specifying the connection strings section of the web config file, and then pointing it to the path where that's located. And I get a succeeded message going back into my Visual Studio. And then I reload that. And now you see my connection strings section. Now my connection strength section is no longer easy to read, but rather I have some very obscure data that I can put out on my web server. Okay. Questions? Yes, sir. Let me get to this gentleman first. I'll be right with you, sir. That's a good question, and there was a reason why I skipped that one slide, because I wanted to see if you guys are still with me, being that it's 5 o'clock. So essentially what we're doing is, first of all, in order for me to encrypt it, I as a user need to have access to that web config file, first and foremost. Second of all, it utilizes the RSA protected configuration by default. I can also pass in another provider through the command line arguments. And then in addition, I have my RSA protected configuration provider, and that is specified by default in the machine.config. So I need access for it, for one. I need to specify, and if I don't specify the RSA, it takes that by default, or I can switch to another provider. And then even if I specify RSA, it looks in the machine config file for the provider that's in there, or the name of the provider. Okay? Question in the back. That answer your question? Oh, you guys are on the same page then. Any other questions? Can't the hacker just decrypt it? Well, as a hacker, what would I need to decrypt it? So essentially, in order for me to decrypt it, I need two things. And what are they? As the first one states in the first bullet, I need to have read-write access to that file. The second thing is I need to be able to have access to the machine config and know which provider was used to encrypt that. So I just used it by default, and it just did that. But if I was to specify through the command line arguments to go through another provider, then it's go fish for the hacker, basically. Okay? Any other questions? All right. So another utility I wanted to look at was the baseline security analyzer. And for that, it's a free tool downloaded from Microsoft. Once I installed it on here, you specify which computer you want it to run on. And obviously, I'm selecting my machine by default. And then it gives you the different options that you can choose for different items to check on that machine. And then go ahead and start the scan. And it should take about a minute. And that will produce a user-friendly report of what is on, off, and what needs attention. And while this is chugging, let me pull up one that has already been produced. So this was a cut and paste earlier of the analysis that I ran on my machine. And as you can see, first it states that I have one or more non-critical checks have failed. These are things that need my attention or the attention of the admin. Things like, as you scroll through, it gives me a list of all the updates that were installed. So one of the issues is some user accounts have a blank or simple password. So that's something that needs my attention. If I had IIS installed, it would also analyze that and tell me what is needed. Incomplete updates as listed here. So on and so forth. So it produced about 9 pages worth of information, all by a simple click of the button, and I was able to gain insight as to how hardened is my infrastructure. And looking at this, it's still chugging, and there's the final report. How many are seeing BSA for the first time? Pretty low-hanging fruit, right? Simple download, run it, and it tells you immediately how well and secure your system is, and free of charge. Any questions about BSA or the registration utility that we've seen? Okay. So now we'll continue on with the PowerPoint. And one of the things that I always like to do is to discuss things that out-of-the-box thinking, if you will. We always think of architecting, where we're starting things from the ground up. This is how an application needs to be built. But the tools that we looked at can really apply to any phase of the application. And the utilities are free of charge. What I want to discuss now are some procedures and guidelines that help with to maintain the proper architecture of a system going forward. And again, it's out-of-the-box thinking, not your traditional security issues. So first, we want to look at engaging the user. And before we even think about engaging a user, I want you to think of security as a holistic solution. As I said before, there is no one magical solution that's going to resolve everything. There is no one utility that takes care of everything. It's a combination of things. First and foremost, start with the very basics. The location of your servers. Where are those housed? Is it a secure location? I actually had a client where they worked in an office building and the air conditioning system was down. And so what they did was they propped open the door to the server room in the middle of a hallway that's accessible by anyone, anyone walking into that office building. And that right there, no matter how much architecture you've built into your application, no matter how much encryption you have, someone could easily walk in and either steal the data or disrupt the service at minimum. So first, you have to look at the location, make sure that's isolated, that not every person can walk in, only specific people. Also look at server configuration. As we've seen earlier with the BSA, it immediately gives us a quick turnaround as far as how hardened our servers are. User training. Don't just publish an application, put it out there to the user, okay, have fun with it, it's user-friendly, everything will be good. You want to engage them and keep them involved, especially users within an organization. Always let them know never to give out passwords. I actually saw a hacker that was interviewed on one of the magazine shows, and he said he was put up to the challenge, and he was given 5 days to break into another organization. And he did it literally within a matter of 10 minutes. What he did was he picked up the phone, and he knew the company phone number was, let's just say, 1-800-123. So he called that first exchange and then dialed any four random digits after that. And I think the second or third person that he contacted was an admin assistant in finance. And he said, "Sue, I just started. Can I have your user ID and password? I need to log in and put in my timesheet before my boss comes and yells at me." And of course, Sue, trying to be the good citizen and help him out, she immediately rendered user ID and password. And within a matter of minutes, he was into the system. Another way of infiltration is the hackers will actually send out faxes. This can be an automated process, and any fax number, it will send a form saying, issuing some kind of a false threat, saying you haven't updated your profile, please fax back this form with your user ID and password before HR takes immediate action. And so, of course, someone who's not knowledgeable will immediately fill out the form and fax it back. So user training is very important, both for our internal users, and we'll talk about how we can also address external users as well. Security code review. How many of you have code review in your organizations? Just general code reviews. How many of you have security code reviews? How many of you have it as separate phases? Wow, I think two hands went up. Okay, so security code review needs to be separate from regular code review. Why is that? We all get into the habit of next, 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 right? Let's get it done, let's get it off my desk. When you have it as a separate phase, you're less likely to go through that next, next step and actually spend time to code review it and have a separate person doing a code review. Just because an application works correctly doesn't mean that it is really secure. And you want to have a list of different attacks, SQL injection attacks, cross-site scripting, so on and so forth. Have a checklist to go through that code review. And then, in addition, just like we go through our unit testing, our system testing, I see some people laughing when they heard unit testing. So if your organization does have a testing phase, security testing should also be an additional phase added onto that. Again, should be separate for the sake of not just pushing things through. And then we're going to talk about active defense, where basically you're taking the offense and making sure that everything functions properly, that the data that you're receiving is within the bounds of what you're expecting. And then, last but not least, always have a recovery plan in mind. What's going to happen if I get hacked? And we'll talk about all those items in detail. So first, engaging the user. One of the things that's been available since IE8, and we're now on IE11, is the highlighting of the domain and the URL. A lot of times through cross-site scripting, it'll actually direct the user to another URL. So we need to let them know, look at the domain and the URL. Is it different? It's usually highlighted, like I said, with an IE8. You want to have user-specific icons for the login. And we'll look at some real-world examples in just a second. So as a user registers for a website, they actually select their own custom icon. And what's this going to do? I'm sorry? Not just next to the URL, but if I select a specific icon for logging in, let's say someone was to hijack my account or hijack the page and what it looks like, right? They're going to be displaying it as a legitimate site through cross-site scripting, but then, what's your name, sir?
Anas.
Anas? So let's say this gentleman will go then and log into that website, and he's encountering a fake site. Once that icon doesn't match the icon he chose, then he knows something is up, and we'll see that in just a second. You want to request the user's immediate notification of any suspicious activity. I once got home, got a call from Citibank, and it wasn't one of those friendly calls, how are you today, we have a low interest rate card to sell you, nothing like that. Mr. Nasser, do you have the card with you? I said, yes. Next to the 3 digits for the verification code, there were an additional 6 digits. Can you read them to me? I read them. It turned out that I was at a gas station just a few minutes prior and was having problems with the card reader, and I had put it in 3 times, and through those 3 swipes, it triggered something on Citibank's side. Why is someone trying to make a gas purchase 3 times in a row for $0 nonetheless? And so I found out that actually it's a hacking routine. What some hackers will do is when they steal a credit card, it's easy to go to one of those self-pay gas pumps, check and see if the card is still good, and if it is, then you can go and really rack up the damage at a retail outlet. However, if you do it directly at a retail outlet, sometimes they get the message where they need to confiscate the card or possibly call the authorities. So it's a quick way for them to verify if the card is still good, and then they can go and do their damage. So this was a credit to Citibank, where they immediately were aware that something was going on, and they alerted the user. They engaged me into the process. Another way of engaging the user is warn them of social engineering. Don't pick up any thumb drives in front of the office door. Don't fax your user ID and password. Don't give out your user ID and password, period, to anybody. Don't click on anything that doesn't seem legit. A couple of my clients, they continue to send emails through their entire enterprise of saying, when you get an email from PayPal, don't click on it. It's a phishing scam. Surprisingly, a lot of people still fall for it today, and it's still ongoing. Also, you want to notify your user of their last login, password changes, and any activity they may have done to their account, again, to keep them involved. Because once a hacker penetrates an account, first thing to do is change the password and be able to gain access through it. As a matter of fact, sometimes they start by doing that, by going through the reset password logic. And because many of us are on Facebook, a lot of us expose whether we're dog lovers or what our favorite color is. And so those tend to be answers to security questions that users, that hackers will look at Facebook and be able to reset the password, answer those security questions, and then essentially take over that account. Everything makes sense so far? Any questions? Okay. So this is an example of what I was referencing earlier. Again, this is a real-world production application. And if you look up on top, you'll see that the URL, since I'm using IE, is highlighted as far as the domain name. So that's something that we want to engage our users in, let them know that's something to keep an eye out for. Also, if you notice, that there is an important security message here. They're requesting that if you see any suspicious activity, call them and let them know that something is not functioning correctly. Backing up from these messages, looking at the general perspective, whenever I log into the website, first it's asking me for an ID and a password, and then once I'm successful, then it takes me to another screen where it's now asking me for a security question, and notice the security question is dotted out. In addition, I have my own custom icon that I chose. Being the proud American, I chose the U.S. flag. So again, they're stating the message, if your secure image does not appear on the screen, contact the 1-800 number immediately. Don't proceed any further. Okay, so this is a real live world example of engaging a user. Again, for the security questions, every time I log in, the security questions are constantly oscillating and moving. So if I miss one, it doesn't immediately go to the next one. It remains hung on that one until I answer correctly. This is an example from Chase, notifying me that there was a purchase of $300 that was made at American Airlines. And I have this. How many of you review your credit card statements every month? Yeah. I'm with the people that didn't raise their hands, by the way. So this is an active way for me to monitor my credit statement. Every time I make a purchase, I have it set that anything over a dollar, I get an email notification of. So, and it's happened a couple times where I've seen a charge for $11 to some obscure humanity fund, and I said, I called them right away. I said, I didn't make that charge. And her response was, oh, we've been getting a lot of those calls lately. It appears to be a scam. Again, some of you may have seen this website. It's called Facebook. So this is a good way. I never have it where I set my browser to constantly stay logged in. Every time I log in, I always want to get this email, because if someone hacked my account, I want to know about it. So I log in every time, and it says, it's given me the breakdown, the date and time, and this machine hasn't been used before. If it's not your login, then you need to take some corrective action. So we talked about engaging the user. Now we can talk about active defense monitoring. So what that means is looking at things that are just out of the norm as far as our application goes. There was an airline in the States that got their website hacked. And remember, when we're talking about hacking, it's not just taking the website down. It's not just credit card theft. Sometimes they like to do their damage and fly under the radar undetected. And so what they did is they found they were able to find a vulnerability in the application where they were able to tell their friends to go to this URL and purchase airline tickets for a dollar. And so it was actually a legitimate purpose, a legitimate purchase rather. And so they kept logging all these $1 tickets, and no one thought, let's put a trigger on the database where we have anything less than $50 to immediately notify systems admin. And so all these charges kept coming in, completely legit as far as everyone was concerned. So you want to have out-of-bounds pricing. If you know for a fact you're never going to have a ticket less than $50, then put a trigger on it. Simply notify a group through email or text notification if something doesn't seem legit. Also look at excessive number of transactions. Similar to the example I gave earlier with Chase, or Citibank rather, every time you swipe a card, if it's more than two times, that's considered excessive. Two times and I didn't make a purchase, something is wrong, right? So it's immediately raising a flag. After hours access, this is becoming less and less prevalent, but it's something to keep in mind because many organizations are now 24-hour operation. But for those that are not, keep in mind that if someone is logging in after hours, it may raise a flag once you detect that. Also, extended login times. For those that are just logged in forever and ever, what could they be looking at through the financial reports that's taking more than an hour? Something might be wrong if they're logged into the intranet and they're in for that long. Again, these are things that it's better to raise a flag and make a call, find out if it is legit, than to just let it slide under the radar. So, security breach strategy. Define a breach, first of all, okay? Did someone hack into our website and deface the coloring scheme? Did someone get into the database? You need to define what constitutes a security breach. The second point may seem kind of odd. Should I allow theft to continue or discontinue? That is a question that needs to be answered by upper management. The reason being, let's say that you work for FTD Florists or FTD.com, and it's around Valentine's Day, and you find out that the website got hacked. Do you pull the plug on the servers and lose possibly millions of dollars of revenue from last-minute flower purchases? Or do you let it go and assume that you're going to be losing less than you're going to be gaining? So these are things that need to be answered ahead of time, because when the time comes, a strategy needs to be in place that should I pull the plug or should I let it continue? Also, law enforcement, in some cases, they always like to let hackers continue to do their work, so they eventually trace them and catch them. So depending whether you're a credit card organization or whether you're an airline or what have you, again, that's something that needs to be identified. When you're talking about millions of dollars at stake and someone that's a thief that's stealing from that, pulling the plug may or may not be the right thing to do. That's something that needs to be answered by upper-level executives. Also, escalation procedure. So I find out that my website got hacked. What do I do at that point? Do I call my CIO? If it's 2 in the morning, do I wake up my boss or do I wait till the next day? Do I escalate it? All these things need to be identified ahead of time. And then define allow and disallowed actions, meaning kind of ties in with the second bullet. Should I let certain actions continue, meaning should I continue to keep FTD.com up and collect orders and collect credit card numbers but not ship anything until I have confirmation that these are legit orders, or should I just continue processing them as I normally would? Any questions about the items we've talked about, engaging the user and the strategies? Yes, sir. So the question is, what about active control? As far as well, that ties into the again that last bullet. Whether you define which actions you're going to allow or disallow. Did that answer your question? Oh, as far as the actual implementation, that is, all these bullets will depend on your own organization. These are things that need to be answered by your own executives. There is really no template that's hard and fast to follow. Every organization functions differently. Everyone has a different strategy. Okay. Any other questions? So, yes, sir.
Slightly off topic, but how does this pertain when you're using something like Azure, where you effectively have third party multiple systems, like Microsoft and this kind of thing? So, clearly, they're also involved in that they are providing the initial layers of security, potentially.
So, your question is how is this involved as far as third party vendors like Microsoft? So how would you involve Microsoft if someone got into your Active Directory is what you're asking?
Is that something that
could be part of your strategy? It may. It depends on, is it something that you can be handled within the organization or do you need additional help for? I mean, Microsoft provides the lock. If someone cuts off the lock, it's really hard to say if it's their fault or not, right? So again, it just varies on the organization. Any other questions? Okay. So this slide talks about post-attack notification. So basically, I've hardened my system as much as possible. I was able to put in as many obfuscations and encryption as much as possible. But then attacks are essentially inevitable. It will happen. So some of the things that need to be identified are the notification of internal management and identify the chain. Also, externally, should I notify the local authorities? Should I notify federal or national authorities? I understand that in the EU, there's a new law that's going to be taking place where a company, if they undergo a security attack, they need to notify the public within 24 hours or they lose a large sum of their yearly revenue. So again, these are things that need to be identified ahead of time. In the U.S., a social security number is very important and highly guarded. I once received a call from a former employer that said there was a box left in the hallway that contained your social security number, but it may or may not have been seen by others. So it's one of those things that we don't know what happened. We just know that your social security number was kind of left unguarded for a while, and we're just notifying you of it. And again, this is by the legalities that are imposed in the U.S. Do you notify local media? Now, again, this is a big question because you could be cutting the bleeding by notifying the media and letting them know, but at the same time, you're cutting your own throat because you're saying, hey, don't shop at my website, we've been hacked. So it's a toss-up, really. It's something, to be discussed with upper management. And then do you post an online warning for users? Check your account, our website has been hacked, or do you just keep it subdued and fly under the radar? And then like we talked about before, do you discontinue the application availability and risk losing millions, or do you continue losing it and hope that you're gonna gain more than you're gonna lose? Again, high dollars, things that involve upper level management. And then this is basically a summary of all the things that we talked about. This will act as your laundry list, essentially go back to your team and say, you know, where are servers located? What kind of configuration is run on them? What's our network configuration looking like? Do we train our users? Do we do code reviews? And if not, let's do them. Same with security testing and active defense. Active defense, in my opinion, again, it's one of those things that's very low-hanging fruit. Put a trigger on a database and modify and watch things as they're being updated for anything that may seem obscure. And then have a recovery plan in place. These things not only help protect data, but they help to protect jobs. So it's very important to take these items and follow through with them. Any questions about these items? Yes, sir.
Does Microsoft provide any tools for the security check?
One more time, please. The question is, does Microsoft provide anything for the code security checks? Yes and no. So the baseline security analyzer does not check the code. It just simply checks the network and the immediate server or machine in my case. But as far as code, if you go through code analysis, there are different sections that you can execute on there, and one of them is for security. And so it checks to see that some of the classes are sealed, and various things all run through code analysis. Are you familiar with that feature?
Maybe not more to that, but it's not really, you know, providing that much insight into the code. For example, that may give you a very brief things. If you have hard-coded the connection string, it may find and then tell you that this connection string is hard-coded there, so you can remove that one and somewhere else. But if there are some other possible security loopholes, that it may not cover. So maybe, I know that there are third-party tools by HP or by someone who can purely secure your, scan your code for security, but not out of the box available for mine. So that was my question.
There are some security rules built in. You can also add in your own as well, but it is not a comprehensive list of everything, no. Okay. Any other questions? All right. So let me ask you, got about 15 minutes left. Let's just do a brief recap. What have you learned from today's session? How many of you have learned one or more things from today's session? All right, what were some of those things that you learned? And I'm counting on the people in the front row that can yell the loudest. What were some of the things that we talked about today? Dotfuscator, right? What does Dotfuscator do? Don't say Dotfuscates. It obscures the code. Another thing that we talked about was the registration tool that does what? Encrypts and decrypts the connection string. Very good. What else did we see?
Sign tool.
Sign tool, very good. And what other utilities did we see that were free of charge? Baseline Security Analyzer, BSA. We talked about some procedural things as listed here for implementing security code reviews and training and having an active defense and recovery plan in place. Some of the references, some of the things that I talked about are in the article listed there in the link and under Visual Studio Magazine. It takes you step by step through walking through DotFuscator, through Sign Tool, and strong naming, which we didn't talk about here. Also, a couple additional links to the Microsoft Assessment Tool and the Security Analyzer. And last but not least, towards the bottom is the encryption and decryption of the connection strings. And once everyone's grabbed a photo of that, we'll move on to the next slide. And my contact information, you can find me on Twitter, Sam Nasser, or feel free to email me at any point in time, sam@nasser.info. And you can also find me on LinkedIn. And I would appreciate it if you take a moment and come and say hello to me afterwards tonight. We're having drinks at Barceloneta Beach, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Also, I will be at the Tech Expo tomorrow from 4 to 5, and then at the Ask the Experts in Hall 5 from 6:30 to 8. Some of the DefTrack resources, Visual Studio and the blogs on MSDN. And then I would appreciate it if you would take the time and fill out the code, fill out the evaluation using the QR code on the screen. Before we close, any last minute questions? Yes, sir. I'm sorry. I can barely hear you. That's why I'm coming towards you.
So I thought that I have a loud voice.
No. Actually, let me grab the mic so everyone can listen in.
If your web pages are in a service provider, so you don't have any access to those machines or so on, how do you shuffle your connection string?
Okay, so the question is, if you're hosting your website at a provider,
somebody else is hosting
at a third party provider, right?
Yes.
It depends on what that provider allows you access to. Some providers, they allow you full access to the server where you can upload, download, or even have physical access to your servers. Others, you're simply buying space on a virtual machine. My opinion, if they don't provide you access to it, go somewhere else. You need to have full control of your application. At the end of the day, it's your revenue that's on the line, not theirs.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I have the mic. I've come this far. Don't hold back. All right. Thank you for coming, and hope to see you tonight. Appreciate it.